Your Honors, this case presents a narrow, straightforward appeal on the interpretation and application of Section 2 on aiding and abetting. The United States believes the District Court erred in dismissing the indictment on the basis the indictment did not allege the Indian status offense element for all aiders and abettors. Under the law, an indictment does not need to allege, nor does the government need to prove, that each aider and abettor satisfies or commits every element of the underlying offense. This court's review is de novo. The facts of this case are very straightforward. On or about December 12, 1975, Annie Mae Aquash was murdered on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. In April of 2003, Arlo Looking Cloud and John Graham were indicted for aiding and abetting in the first-degree murder of Aquash under Section 1111, 1153, and 2. Looking Cloud's Indian status was specifically set forth in that indictment, as well as the Indian country element offense. In February of 2004, Looking Cloud's trial was held. Graham was involved in a lengthy extradition from Canada, so he did not participate in that trial. Looking Cloud was ultimately convicted, and this court affirmed that conviction, set forth at 419 Fed 3rd 781. On October 3rd, 2008, three days before the scheduled jury trial, the indictment was dismissed. The district court correctly determined it had jurisdiction under Section 3231. However, it concluded that the indictment failed to set forth all essential elements, namely the Indian status with respect to Defendant Graham. The issue on Section 2 lends itself to a straightforward analysis of the text of the statute, the legislative history, and the case precedent on aiding and abetting. Section 2 specifically provides, quote, whoever willfully causes an act to be done, which if directly performed by him or another, would be an offense against the United States, end quote. The 03 indictment alleges that defendants Looking Cloud, an Indian, and Graham, quote, did unlawfully kill and aid and abet in the unlawful killing of Annie Mae Aquash. By the very terms of Section 2, if acts performed by another, in this case Looking Cloud, would be an offense against the United States, then Graham can be held criminally liable for aiding and abetting. The offense against the United States is the murder of Aquash in Indian country by an Indian, that being Looking Cloud.
Counsel, there's no dispute, I take it by your briefs, that state courts would have jurisdiction if the federal courts didn't.
You know, I would venture to guess that an argument could be made by defense counsel that if there is 1153 jurisdiction, that would be an exclusive jurisdiction. But I think in the event that the federal court doesn't have jurisdiction, there's certainly a state court jurisdiction over the kidnapping that went from Denver through Rapid City, South Dakota, onto the reservation, as well as with respect to the alleged rape that occurred in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is off.
Seems to me like the defendant can't have it both ways and say he's not in federal court, but he's not in state court. That's what I heard you say on part of that answer.
Well, I don't want to speak for the defendant. I would guess if
you think
this
he'll try to have it both ways. That's what I hear
I
you cynically
would expect
say.
That.
Okay.
And I think we've seen that in other cases, for instance, the Daniels case out of the Washington appellate court.
Must the indictment set forth the basis for federal jurisdiction over a defendant?
I think over the criminal venture, yes, but not over a specific defendant. In other words,
what does that mean?
Well, this indictment, I think an indictment has to set forth the essential elements of the offense. Because of 1153, There's two additional.
I'm not talking about elements of the offense. I'm talking about jurisdiction, ability of the court to try a particular person.
It's the United States' position that Section 3231 gives the district court jurisdiction, the power to adjudicate criminal prosecutions. I think that in combination with the fact that this indictment set forth 1153, Section 1111, the underlying offense in Section 2, the district court as well as this court has jurisdiction over this prosecution.
Well, the only way that Mr. Graham is subject to the jurisdiction of the court would be based upon the fact that he is an Indian.
Or that it's the United States' position, or that he aided and abetted other Indians in commission of the offense.
Well, I know that's your argument, but he must be I mean, Section 1153 provides that the jurisdictional basis for the prosecution of Indians where the crime is one of the enumerated crimes, the crime takes place in Indian country. And what stumps me here is that this indictment does not specify that Mr. Graham is an Indian.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I don't see any law cited that permits Section 2 to bring someone in to the court's jurisdiction based upon aiding and abetting status. I understand your argument about aiding and abetting, and certainly that's a well-established principle. But what can you show the court that provides jurisdiction based upon some concept of aiding and abetting
this
with respect to a status?
This specific case is a case of first impression. What I can point to is, for instance, the Rector decision by the Eighth Circuit that says that aiding and abetting applies across the board. It's a general criminal applicability. There is no Indian country exception built in Section 2. It applies in Indian country. To further that argument, I can cite the Looking Cloud case, which was a Section 2 case.
Well, but I think what I'm hearing Judge Shepherd say is there's a difference between a crime and jurisdiction over an act. You have an act creates a crime, but you have a jurisdiction over who can try that crime, that act. So why this law you cite and the argument you make it works as far as the crime's concerned, but how does it speak to jurisdiction?
I think when you speak straight to jurisdiction, I think reliance upon both the Pemberton decision and the Whitehorse decision sets forth, and I quote, a dispute over a defendant's status as an Indian or a non-Indian, while relevant to the matter of proof at trial, does not deprive the district court of jurisdiction. In other words, the Indian status and the location, the status of Indian country, these are elements of the offense. They don't go to the jurisdictional power to adjudicate. And I think to take off on that argument are the line of cases, Sigolo, Lester, Standeffer, cases.
So are you saying that Indian status under Section 1153 is not necessary in order for the prosecution to take place in federal court?
I'm saying it is necessary as an element of the offense, not necessary as a pure jurisdictional argument on the power to adjudicate. It is necessary as an element of an offense, and that element of an offense can be established, as in this case, when one of the actors is of Indian status. I think it's the same concept of when you have a Section 1983 action acting under color of state law, where you have private citizens that can be held responsible for aiding and abetting officers, even though...
Counsel, I may not understand what you and Judge Shepherd are saying, but you said it's first impression, and Norquay has a flat sentence. You know what the flat sentence is. You quote it in your brief. The other side quotes it. How can you say it's first impression when you have that flat sentence in an Eighth Circuit case, United States versus Norquay, I believe you say it?
Because when you look at the Norquay decision, that clearly was not a Section 2 case. There is no Section 2 analysis. What was occurring in Norquay was the Eighth Circuit was sorting out sentencing issues, whether the federal sentencing guidelines were going to be applied or the Minnesota guidelines.
You claim
were going
it's
to be
dicta.
Applied. Correct. That it was a passing reference in the disposition of a separate argument made with respect to sentencing guidelines. It did not specifically address the issue that we have here today on Section 2. And with respect to the Norquay decision, I would point out the recognition that was provided to 1153 when the Norquay decision in citing the Big Crow case indicated that 1153's purpose is to ensure that Indians and non-Indians committing the same offense on the same reservation all be subject to the same punishment. And that's really what we have occurring here today. And I think that goes to show...
Does the sentence you just quoted depend upon who the victim is? Can the dicta in Norquay be reconciled with what you just said depending on who the victim is? Or the victim's an Indian or non-Indian, if I'm not clear.
I think it could be because when you look at the Indian status issue, I think it's fair to say it gives the Indian the element of Indian. And that's the United States position with this case, the Graham case, is there is an Indian element. This isn't a straight white-on-white situation. We have a situation where we have a murder in Indian country, where we have a non-Indian and Indian, for purposes of the 03 indictment, aiding and abetting in that same murder. They both walked her up to a cliff. There's a position that Looking Cloud has taken that Graham was the trigger man. Those are issues for proof at trial. But I think that shows the purpose of Section 2 to ease the prosecutor's burden, that we may not know and be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt who actually pulled the trigger, but these two in concert joined in a criminal adventure to murder Aquash, and they did that on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Thus, this court has jurisdiction under 3231. The United States did set forth all the elements.
Now, counsel, I'm interrupting you, for your time's short, and I think we just need to clarify. The indictment we are talking about doesn't say that the victim is an Indian, right?
Correct.
But the indictment you filed that's below does say that the victim is an Indian, right?
Correct. After this case was dismissed, the United States moved forward and set forth the three-count indictment. Count 1 setting forth the Indian status of Graham under 1153, count 2 setting forth the Indian status of Aquash under 1152, and then count 3 addressing the aiding and abetting theory, where the United States' burden is eased on the status element to just simply show that an Indian was involved in this offense, not that Graham himself is.
That's the so-called 2008 indictment that's pending below, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Going back to 1153, the statute clearly says any Indian who commits a crime against an Indian or other person within Indian country. What you're wanting us to read that to say is any Indian or aider or abettor of any Indian who commits a crime.
The answer is yes, because aiding and abetting is a crime of general applicability. The case law says that beginning on Rector on. And so it's no different than the Dodge case's application of 371 in Indian country, a statute of general applicability, when it brought in a conspiracy case, a non-Indian, because he conspired in a burglary with an Indian. It's the same concept. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, I would reserve remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you for letting me argue this case. I'd like to start, if I could, with a plain language analysis of the three operative statutes. In my brief and in the district court's decision, there wasn't much discussion about the plain language of the three statutes. Instead, there was an extensive discussion of the case law going from 1880 to the present that interpreted these three statutes. And I think it was a deficiency on my part. What I looked at when I was reading the government's brief, at page 6 of the government's brief, they take fault with the district court's lack of extensive analysis on the theory presented here today. And so I went to the district court's opinion, and the district court very concisely said their position lacks authority, so it disregarded it. And when I put the brief together, I reviewed extensive number of cases culminating in the Norquay case that was just discussed, and the case law clearly stands for one proposition, and that is that a non-Indian accomplice is not subject to prosecution under 1153.
Well, if the case law subject to prosecution in federal court? Are they subject to prosecution in state court?
I believe so, and I don't believe the discussion about having it both ways is really appropriate, because from McBratney in 1882 on, the line of cases has been clear that those persons not subject to federal jurisdiction for crimes in Indian country are subject to state court jurisdiction, with the rare exception of some tribal court jurisdiction for Indian crimes that aren't major acts. So the McBratney case on forward is clearly established that if he's not subject to this court's or the district court's jurisdiction, he will be subject to state court jurisdiction. But so let's look at the plain language of the three statutes at issue and consider them in their context with the policy and object in mind. Starting with 18 U.S.C. 2, the statute that the government relies on most heavily, let's consider that in context of 18 U.S.C. 2 and Section 3. Those are punishment statutes. They clearly state that accomplices, whether accessories or aiders and abettors, are subject to certain punishments if they're properly prosecuted in federal court. That's the paramount issue, is first, they have to be properly subject to punishment in federal court. But if they are, then 18 U.S.C. 2 and 3 set forth the appropriate punishments for accomplices. There is nothing in the plain language of 18 U.S.C. 2 that evinces any intent by Congress to expand the federal court's realm of jurisdiction into that delicate balance that is drawn between states, tribes, and the federal government. There's certainly nothing in 18 U.S.C. 2 that indicates an intent by Congress to override the express language of 1153. 1153's plain language is that this applies to Indian defendants. So if you look at 18 U.S.C. 2 and you look at 18 U.S.C. 3, you see these are punishment statutes that are premised upon there being a proper prosecution in federal court. They don't expand or rearrange the spheres of sovereignty and jurisdiction that are part and parcel of all of our federal criminal Indian statutes. If we go beyond 18 U.S.C. 2, then we go to 18 U.S.C. 1153, the substantive offense here. The plain language of that statute says it applies to Indians or Indian defendants in Indian country. And I don't think we can look at that and say there was an oversight by Congress or an accident in not including the aiding and abetting language. Congress very clearly was trying to create a very narrow class of cases that permit the federal government to exercise exclusive jurisdiction. They said Indian defendants. 1152 says Indian victims. They're very specific, and we've got about 200 years of Congress trying to create a balancing act between the realms of jurisdiction by tribes, states, and the federal government. If we put 1153 in its proper context, we understand that what Congress was doing was trying to advance its guardian-ward relationship with Indian tribes and their members. Clearly, what they were doing is trying to protect Indian people and their tribes from overexpansive reaches by states and not subjecting Indian defendants who commit crimes in Indian country to state jurisdiction. If Congress had wanted the interpretation that the government seeks in this case, Congress could have said that the Major Crimes Act applies to all crimes committed in Indian country. It did not. There would be nothing constitutional that would have prevented that. But they said it applies to Indian defendants in Indian country. There's no policy promoted when non-Indians are subject to federal jurisdiction under 1153. Non-Indians aren't in a guardian-ward relationship with the United States government. They are properly the subject of the states or, in limited circumstances, the tribal courts. But that policy that is behind 1153 is not advanced when a non-Indian, such as Mr. Graham, as he's charged in the 2003 indictment, is brought in, pulled in. And, you know, the Norquay decision, the Torres decision, the Dodge decision, and the Bruce decision all stand for that proposition. When they say non-Indian accomplices are not subject to federal jurisdiction under 1153, they mean exactly what they say. And that advances the purposes set forth. Now, the government has relied upon...
I'm going to interrupt you to ask this question. Is there... Maybe I should ask the government this, but do you anticipate that if and when this case is ever tried, there will be some difficulty in proving that Mr. Graham is an Indian?
Oh, I believe so, yes.
Is that what gives rise to this?
Very much so, Your Honor, and that's been the source of extensive litigation in the present file, is whether a Canadian indigenous person meets the definition of an Indian and has Indian blood for the definition of this statute. That's a point of serious litigation.
I was about to interrupt and ask you the same question. I'm not trying to get you committed to a position, but is what we're talking about here is you have a Canadian Indian and you have an American Indian, and the question is whether the Canadian Indian falls under the federal statute of definition of an American Indian?
Well, I think that's going to be a point of litigation in the 2008 file. It's already been the subject of a pending motion to dismiss and jury instructions as to what the case law says about what an Indian is for the purposes of 18 U.S.C. 1153 and 1152. So I don't know if that answers your question accurately.
Well, I'm just curious, and again, it's maybe for the government, but why they did not at least allege that Mr. Graham was an Indian.
Well, doing the 2008 indictment, right?
He does.
In the 2008 indictment, they say that, right?
They say he's an Indian and he's not an Indian. They've alleged it both ways.
In the 2008 indictment.
Exactly.
Now, mentioning that indictment, why doesn't the fact that Mr. Graham has been re-indicted in this multiple count indictment that apparently is an effort to cover, have it both ways, why doesn't that make this case moot? Is this something that we have to even address in view of the fact that Mr. Graham now faces a subsequent indictment that takes care of the problem?
Well, that was exactly the point of my motion to dismiss this appeal, Your Honor, that's being considered contemporaneously with this argument. I moved to dismiss on that very ground that this has been mooted by the 2008 appeal or the 2008 indictment. One of the things that's interesting about the procedural history of this case is there was no necessity for the government to go ahead with the 2008 indictment. They actually filed this notice of appeal after they re-indicted him. They could have taken an immediate appeal from Judge Pearsall's decision in the 2003 file. They could have asked for a stay of the proceedings, kept Mr. Graham in custody, appealed this to its logical end, gotten a decision, and then gone on with the case. Instead, what they did is they re-indicted him, alleging that Mr. Graham is an Indian and that he's not an Indian, and then filed notice of appeal here, which I think makes this case really an advisory case to the pending motions to dismiss in the 2008 file, which are exactly the arguments I made in my
counsel,
motion.
Is count three of the 2008 indictment the same as the count in this indictment?
It is, and the government...
Oh, is it word for word the same?
I don't believe it's word for word, but the government concedes in its brief. I think they say it's substantially the same. It alleges exactly the same subject matter, fails to allege that Graham is an Indian, fails to allege that Aquash is an Indian. It's the same charge, whether it's word for word, comment for comment.
And that is still subject to a pending motion to dismiss.
That is,
you
Your
both
Honor.
Say.
That is, Your Honor.
Does that make this, does that take away the mootness of this case? Because this case will decide, my guess is Judge Pearsall is waiting for this case to rule on that, but he may not be, but since he's ruled on that once, in our ruling here, one way or another, if we rule on it, does that then make it the law of the case where he's not going to change his mind?
Well, I think that goes to whether this becomes an advisory body then. And that's what my concern is that if that is in fact the case, that he's awaiting a decision here, this then becomes an advisory decision.
Yeah, but is it pointless, assuming that we think the district judge will stay with his same position, he's going to dismiss count three, right?
I would assume so. I can't
right.
speak, obviously.
So dismissing the appeal and sending it back, he may be pointless. You'd agree to that, too?
No, I wouldn't. I would agree that dismissing the appeal is the right thing to do. I don't understand.
But if we reverse, mm-hmm. then it's no longer pointless, because then we say that he was wrong and count three of the new indictment would go forward.
Well, if you reverse, that complicates things even further, because then we have a 2003 indictment and a 2008 indictment alleging the same crime. That is one of the other arguments I raised in the motion to dismiss, is that puts us in a real complicated posture, and that we have the same murder charge pending in two indictments, one where my client's charged with a co-defendant, Mr. Marshall, one in which he's not. If I may return to the
so now you're telling me count three is different.
No, I'm not saying
than the previous indictment.
No, I'm just saying.
Help me, because I didn't understand your last point.
What I'm saying is, if this court reversed Judge Pearsall's decision,
right.
then count one, the only count in the 2003 indictment, would be alive,
right.
and count three, the same count, same charge in the 2008 decision, would be alive, and we'd have two charges and two separate files pending, charging the exact same crime against my client.
Of course, I'm used to state practice. In state practice, that'd be no problem. Tell me why that's a problem in federal practice. You don't have to give me any lecture, just a short summary of why.
Well,
it's a problem.
I think the issue then is exposing my client to the prospect of defending himself in two cases if those indictments are not joined for trial.
Yeah, then go ahead. Proceed. It's like state practice. Proceed.
Since I have limited time left, the issue about 3231 has been, I think, vastly overstated in its significance in this case. That's a very straightforward statute. It says two things. It says the federal district courts have jurisdiction to prosecute or to adjudicate federal crimes, which certainly isn't controversial in this case. But the second part of that statute is really important. It says if federal courts don't properly have the power to adjudicate, nothing in the statute should impair or take away the state court's authority to adjudicate the case. And that's entirely consistent with McBratney and 130 years of cases afterwards, which say non-Indian defendants are not subject to federal prosecution under 1153. To follow up on your comments, Mr. Judge Shepherd, I believe the indictment in this case does have to set forth a basis for jurisdiction over Mr. Graham, over the person, because that's what 1153 says by its plain language. It says it only applies to Indians. So merely alleging the subject matter of a murder in Indian country, as it, this case did, that is not sufficient. And that's the law cited throughout our brief, Norquay, Torres, and Dodge. I think the Dodge decision is interesting because that case was relied upon heavily by Judge Pearsall. In that case, the court dismissed an aiding and abetting burglary charge against Flory, a non-Indian. So there was an 18 U.S.C. 2 aspect to that case, but said Flory could be prosecuted under another statute, a conspiracy statute, which has not been charged in this case. So that case was relied upon by Judge Pearsall heavily. I relied on Norquay, Torres, and others. Mr. Jackley indicated that there is no Indian country exception to 18 U.S.C. 2. Granted, but more importantly, there's no aiding and abetting exception in 18 U.S.C. 1153. That's what I think is the operative statute. We're looking at a prosecution under 1153, and there's nothing in that statute by its language or its history that indicates any intent by Congress to allow non-Indians to be pulled into that sphere of jurisdiction. I would also dispute the assertion that Norquay is dicta. Norquay was a case prosecuted under 1153. That is the statute here. And the court said, and it didn't have an 18 U.S.C. 2 aspect to it because it had already been determined, and the court treats it as a matter of some just assumed controlling law that because the other defendant was non-Indian, he wasn't subject to a prosecution under 1153. He was, under McBratney, subject to state prosecution. So it's not dicta. The court directly addresses the issue, and I think we tend to want to make every case that doesn't support our position appear to be a dicta statement, and that doesn't seem to be here.
Counsel, I noticed this court, of course, has the statement you talk about, cites McBratney without a page cite. Mm-hmm. Is the statement from McBratney a quote? I assume it's not.
Is that in a parenthetical of my brief?
Yeah.
If it's in a parenthetical without quotes, then it would be a paraphrase, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, not talking about your brief. I'm talking about this court in the Norquay case.
Oh, I would assume if it's not in quotes, it was paraphrasing. But McBratney is very concrete on one point, and that is that non-Indians are not subject to federal prosecution under 1153. And that really hasn't been impeached in 130 years since the decision. I see my time is out. Thank you for letting us speak.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. How much time does Mr. Jackley have?
4 minutes.
Okay, Mr. Jackley.
Your Honors, this appeal is not moot because this court can, in fact, give meaningful relief. That meaningful relief is to reinstate the 03 indictment, at which point in time we're not going to seek two separate trials. We would join the 03 and the 08 indictments for trial, and the jury would then hear the issues with respect to that case. So it's not moot. It offers
you could dismiss the 03 indictment and just go forward in the 08, right?
We would prefer to join it, but we could do that also.
Yeah, you can do that also. Thank you.
The other point I did want to make, too, is on Dodge, it takes a careful reading because I strongly disagree with counsel's interpretation of the facts in Dodge. There were two different burglaries in Dodge, and I read directly from Dodge. Accordingly, we reverse the conviction of Flory for the burglary against a non-Indian on a reservation for lack of jurisdiction. So a non-Indian that burglarizes alone a non-Indian's place, there is no jurisdiction. But when you add the Indian element that was in the conspiracy one of his other burglary, the court says jurisdiction over Flory, a non-Indian, for his alleged participation in a conspiracy to commit, acts or obstruct, impede, and interfere with law enforcement, etc., is found under the general criminal laws of the United States that apply whenever citizens are within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, including Indian reservations. Dodge stands for the principle that when you have an Indian element, there is federal jurisdiction. And in fact, the clear language of McBratney provides that. And I'll quote from McBratney that specifically dealt with, quote, murder committed by a white man upon a white person, end quote. That isn't what happened with Aquash. She was murdered by Looking Cloud, an Indian, and Graham, whose status is uncertain. This point was specifically noted by the Eighth Circuit in the Goings case that recognized that under McBratney, quote, state courts have exclusive jurisdiction of offenses committed solely between non-Indians and non-Indians on the reservation, end quote. Emphasis on the solely. And then finally, the United States Supreme Court in the New York Martin case makes the same point, recognizing McBratney applies, quote, to crimes between whites and whites, which do not affect Indians, end quote. This case affected Indians by Looking Cloud's activity in the criminal venture. Your Honors, I also wanted to address the questions regarding Section 2's expansion. And it's the United States position that Section 2 has expanded the ability to prosecute irrespective of defendant statuses under many statutes. An example, under the Lester case, that expansion of a Section 1983 action went to private citizens. Under the Sigalow case, the actors not involved in the interstate nexus activity could also be prosecuted. And similarly, under the Standeffer case, that dealt with an offense limited to officers and employees of the United States, that prosecution of criminal liability was expanded to private citizens. It's no different with respect to 1153. Congress spoke when it would put in place aiding and abetting. The text of aiding and abetting says that. The legislative history of aiding and abetting indicates that. And the broad interpretation provided by courts further indicates that. In fact, I think it was best placed by the Sigalow Court in indicating that Section 2 eases the prosecution's burden so that it was not necessary to show the interstate nature of each defendant's activity. Similar, the United States does not
have... Isn't that just the point? Aiding and abetting seems to me refers to conduct rather than status. How can one aid and abet a status?
It's exactly what occurred with respect to the police officers in the 1983 action cases. The private citizens could never be the status of a police officer. However, because of Section 2, they were criminally liable when they made a knowing decision to join a criminal venture and participate in that criminal venture. For purposes of judicial economy, it makes sense to have just one trial over it.
But wouldn't that relate to aiding and abetting an action under state law? It would be just a totally different scenario than what we have here, where the government is attempting to argue that a person can aid and abet, as I would put it, a status.
The Standeffer case, though, dealt
an identity.
The Standeffer case dealt specifically with a federal statute, not interpretation of state law, with respect to liability of United States employees and officers, and extended that liability to private citizens. I see my time is up. Are there any further questions, Your Honor?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument. Very interesting case, and we will do our best to resolve it as soon as possible. Thank you. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning, 9 a.m.